The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like me. My name is Catherine Futch, and I am currently a senior at Georgia College and State University studying mass communication with a concentration in marketing and journalism. I am a 2021 graduate of the World Journalism Institute. WJI equipped me in so many ways, but one way that stands out to me is how it showed me what it meant to pursue a meaningful story. Everyone has a story, and as journalists, it is our job to be the medium through which those stories reach publication. WJI is accepting applications right now for the May course at Dort University. If you are a college student or recent graduate interested in journalism, check it out at WJI.world. That is WJI.world. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. A record number of congressional Democrats are retiring this year. We'll find out why and what it might mean for this year's midterms.
We'll talk about that today on Washington Wednesday. Also today, World Tour. Plus, we'll hear from one of the organizations that encouraged Christians to boycott the recently concluded Winter Olympics.
Right now, China is desperate for the attention and for the world to sort of overlook all that's gone on.
And the importance of teaching children how to manage money.
It's Wednesday, February 23rd. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Nick Eicher.
News is next. Here's Kent Covington.
The face-off over Russia's aggression toward Ukraine escalated dramatically on Tuesday. Russia's rubber-stamp parliament, known as the Duma, gave the green light for President Vladimir Putin to use military force outside of his country. And President Biden and European leaders responded by slapping sanctions on Russian oligarchs and banks. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told reporters,
"This is the most dangerous moment in European security for a generation. But Europe and North America continue to stand strong together in NATO."
More than two dozen EU nations unanimously agreed to levy their own initial set of sanctions against Russian officials. Germany also said it was halting the lucrative Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia. Biden said the United States is sanctioning two Russian banks and blocking them from trading in debt on American and European markets.
"That means we've cut off Russia's government from Western financing."
One day earlier, Putin declared that parts of Ukraine held by pro-Russian separatists are no longer part of Ukraine. And he then began moving so-called peacekeeping forces into separatist-controlled regions. The White House on Tuesday held back on the toughest sanctions for the time being. Biden said he will unleash them if Russia further invades Ukraine, but he said he fears it's likely only a matter of time.
"He's setting up a rationale to go much further. This is the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, as he indicated and asked permission to be able to do from his Duma."
Biden also said he is moving additional U.S. troops to the Baltics on NATO's eastern flank, but he emphasized that it is purely a defensive move. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a new clash between First Amendment liberties and a Colorado state discrimination law. World's Kristen Flavin has more.
The High Court said Tuesday it would hear the case of Lori Smith. The Denver area designer offers graphic and website design services and wants to expand to wedding website services. But she says her Christian beliefs would lead her to decline any request from a same-sex couple to design a wedding website. She also wants to post a statement on her website about her beliefs. Doing those things, however, would run afoul of a Colorado anti-discrimination law. Smith says that is a clear violation of her constitutional free speech and religious rights. The Supreme Court said in taking the case that it would only look at the free speech issue. It said it would decide whether a law that requires an artist to speak or stay silent violates the free speech clause of the First Amendment. The court is expected to hear arguments in the fall. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
The three white men convicted of murder in the death of Ahmaud Arbery were found guilty on Tuesday of federal hate crimes. A jury found that father and son Greg and Travis McMichael and neighbor William Bryan violated Arbery's civil rights. The court also convicted the McMichaels of using a firearm in the commission of a violent crime, and it found all three defendants guilty of attempted kidnapping. The verdict came just one day before the second anniversary of Arbery's death in February of 2020 in South Georgia. Attorney General Merrick Garland said Tuesday,
The defendants' actions and the racism that fueled them have inflicted enduring trauma on Mr. Arbery's family, his friends, his community.
Arbery's father, Marcus Arbery Sr., and his mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, emerged from the courthouse holding hands with their attorney, Ben Crump, then raised their clasped hands to cheers from supporters. Cooper Jones called the ruling a legal win, but she said it will never be enough.
We as a family will never get victory because Ahmaud is gone forever.
Come on. Yeah.
The defendants, who were already sentenced to life in prison by the state of Georgia, now await sentencing on the federal convictions. U.S. women's soccer players have reached a massive settlement with the sport's American governing body to end a long legal battle over equal pay. World's Anna Johansson-Brown has that story.
The $22 million agreement closes a six-year class action equal pay lawsuit. Five players complained to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in 2016 that the USSF underpaid them and did not provide adequate working conditions for women. In 2019, more than 20 other women from the national team sued for damages under the Equal Pay Act and gender discrimination under the Civil Rights Act. The U.S. Soccer Federation, or USSF, will also establish a $2 million fund for players in post-soccer careers, as well as charitable efforts. The federation also committed to an equal pay rate for the men's and women's national teams, pending approval of a new collective bargaining agreement. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson-Brown.
And I'm Kent Covington. Straight ahead, House Democrats bailing out ahead of November's midterm elections, plus important lessons for the next generation. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Wednesday, the 23rd of February, 2022. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Nick Eicher. First up today, Democratic retirements. The number of House Democrats who will not seek re-election this year has just hit a 30-year high. Most recently, New York Congresswoman Kathleen Rice said she won't run again. That made her the 30th Democrat in the House to throw in the towel.
Yeah, it's the first time since 1992 that so many Democrats have retired. And the Brookings Institution says it's just the third time since 1978 that 30 members of either party have retired in a single cycle.
All right, well, joining us now to help explain what this exodus could mean for the midterm elections in November is Kyle Condick. He is an elections analyst and director of communications at the University of Virginia Center for Politics.
Kyle, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, as we mentioned, it's pretty rare for one party to have 30 or more members retire in a single election cycle. So what's behind it this time around, Kyle?
There are a combination of a number of factors that I think are contributing to the large number of Democratic retirements. This is a redistricting year, and so there are almost always more retirements or higher level of retirements in redistricting years. You know, election years that end in two, that the census comes out every 10 years, the states have to redraw districts to account for population changes. And what ends up happening is there are some states that actually lose a House seat or two because of slow population growth, the other states that gain, but particularly in the states that lose, you know, there's going to be someone who ends up retiring or is forced into a primary general election with another member. So that contributes to the high number of retirements. I don't think it's a coincidence that this is the highest number since 1992, which also was a redistricting year that saw a lot of retirements prompted by redistricting. However, it's also common for a party that perhaps believes in its heart of hearts that maybe they won't be in the majority come, you know, after the next election, for members to decide that that's a good year to leave, either because the members themselves are afraid of losing their reelection bids, or maybe they feel like they are going to win again, but they don't want to serve in the minority in the next Congress. And so I do think you can sometimes interpret, you know, an imbalance of retirements on one side or the other as being a bad sign for the party that has more retirements. Can sometimes be a signal of pessimism, I guess, for the majority party. And I think it's probably fair to interpret some of these retirements that way for Democrats in 2022.
You just mentioned redistricting. So how big of a factor, you know, is it in this wave of retirements, if you had to gauge?
You know, it's contributing to some retirements. One good example is Jim Cooper, a Democrat who represents Nashville. Of course, Tennessee is a pretty Republican state, and one of the things that Republican legislators did in that state was they chopped up Nashville into basically three different districts. And so instead of there being one safely Democratic seat in Nashville, there are now three pretty safe Republican seats that cover Davidson County, where Nashville is. And so I think you would definitely classify him as a redistricting casualty. But you also have some other members who are from sort of swing districts who, in the case of Sherry Bustos in Illinois, a Democrat, she retired relatively early in the cycle. Her district was actually made better by Democratic state legislators, but she still decided to retire. You also have on the other side of the Illinois border in Wisconsin, you have Ron Kind. His district hasn't actually been drawn yet, but he's retiring too. That's a district that covers a lot of places where Barack Obama did pretty well in 2008, 2012, but then shifted to Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020. He's another swing district member who I think would have been in real danger of losing in 2022. Some other members like Kathleen Rice, she's in a district that Democrats probably should be able to hold. But, there are all sorts of reasons why members retire. And ultimately, only the members know, in their heart of hearts, whatever they say publicly, privately, why they decided to retire. But I think the political environment could be contributing to at least some of these retirements.
Right, right. Kyle, you said something recently that I thought was interesting. You said incumbency is not as valuable as it used to be. How about explaining that?
Yeah, it used to be that incumbents had an easier time running ahead or sometimes well ahead of the kind of partisan baseline in their districts. And it used to be pretty common for members of one party to win a district, even though the district was voting for the other party for president. But the number of those kinds of districts has declined precipitously in recent years. There were only 16 districts out of all 435 that voted for one party for president, one party for House in the 2020 election. That was basically the lowest number on record going back to the early 1950s, and is probably the lowest number in at least 100 years. So just the value of being an incumbent and being able to outspend and your opponent and being better known, et cetera, it just isn't as electorally valuable as it used to be, although a party generally would still rather have an incumbent defending a seat than for it to be open, and particularly in kind of a midterm wave year, as this might be in favor of Republicans, you sometimes see more erosion in the presidential party performance in open seats as opposed to incumbent-held seats. But incumbents just aren't as hard to beat as they used to be.
Kyle, how many seats are vulnerable for Democrats as compared to Republicans?
That's yet to be determined because some of the districts aren't drawn yet. But the bottom line is that the Democrats are defending more seats that we rate as toss ups. And there's also been, some seats that have shifted from being a handful have gone from being more Republican leaning to more Democratic leaning. But there have also been others that have gone from Democratic leaning to Republican leaning. I think the Republicans only need to pick up win five more seats than they won in 2020 in order to flip the House. I think they're in good position to do that. How big the playing field is, I think, is again still to be determined because of redistricting and candidate recruitment and other things. It's not entirely clear yet. But I think for Republicans, one of the goals probably could be or should be to see if they can get win 35 net seats this time, which would allow them to win 248 seats, which would be the biggest Republican House majority since right before the Great Depression. To be clear, I wouldn't necessarily pick them to do that right now. I would think their gains would be smaller than that, although I do still think they're pretty clearly favored to win the House. But that's a number to keep in mind, that 35 number. And there are going to be enough targets for Republicans to get to that number, although they'd have to flip a lot of Democratic-leaning turf in order to do so.
Okay, let's move now. Let's talk about storylines. What are the major storylines you're watching right now in the battle for either the House or the Senate?
I think the big picture takeaway here, the most important thing is just that the president has a weak approval rating right now. Midterms are often a struggle for the president's party, particularly if the president has low level of popularity as Biden has now. We saw this 4 years ago with Donald Trump being in a somewhat similar boat, and Republicans did poorly, at least in the House. The Senate was a little bit of a different story because the Senate playing field was so so good for Republicans, even though the environment was bad. And so they were able to make a small gain in the Senate. But at least in the House, you know, I think that, Republicans are set up pretty well so long as Biden remains unpopular. And so there are all sorts of things that go into the president's approval rating and, you know, what has hurt him over the past several months. But the bottom line is his numbers are weak and they're not necessarily getting better. And I think Democrats need them to get better in order to have, you know, a fighting chance to hold the House.
Kyle, we've talked a lot about the House today, but how do you see the battle for the Senate shaping up?
Senate's 50-50 right now. You know, the Democrats are defending vulnerable seats in Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, New Hampshire. The Republicans have to, you know, have to defend their own vulnerable seats in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, North Carolina. There are some other races that may be competitive down the line. But, you know, again, with Biden's approval as low as it is, I think you'd expect the Republicans to be able to net at least the one seat that they would need to win the Senate. I think, again, Nevada, Georgia, and Arizona stand out, I think, as being vulnerable on the Democratic side. You'd probably expect the Republicans to flip at least one of them at the end of the day, if Biden's numbers don't improve.
All right. Kyle Condick with the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you.
Additional support comes from Wednesday in the Word, the podcast about what the Bible means and how we know. New every Wednesday on podcast apps or browse over a decade of episodes at WednesdayInTheWord.com. And from World Help, a Christian organization delivering food and Bibles to underground believers in North Korea. More at worldhelp.net/podcast.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, World Tour with our reporter in Africa. Here's Onize Ohikere.
We start today in West Africa. An explosion at a gold mine in Burkina Faso on Monday killed at least 59 people and injured 100 others. The region's high commissioner said explosives stored at the mine likely caused the blast, but investigators are still trying to figure out exactly what happened. Burkina Faso is the fastest-growing gold producer in Africa. Gold is the country's most important export. About 1.5 million people work in the industry. Small mines like the one where Monday's accident happened are becoming more common, and much of the gold dug from them is smuggled into neighboring Togo, Benin, Niger, and Ghana. Small mines also attract jihadists linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. The militants tax miners to raise funds and use the sites for recruiting and to seek refuge. Next, we go to South America. Colombia's highest court legalized abortion through 24 weeks of pregnancy in a ruling issued Monday. Abortion activists celebrated outside the Supreme Court building in Bogota. Pro-life advocates held a more subdued rally. They waved flags, prayed, and held up photos of women who died after legal abortions. The New York-based Center for Reproductive Rights helped file the lawsuit that eventually overturned Colombia's abortion restrictions. A lawyer who worked on the case said the group's goal was complete decriminalization of abortion. Prior to the High Court ruling, Colombia only allowed abortion when the mother's life was in danger, the baby was diagnosed with abnormalities, or in cases of rape. Colombia is just the latest country in Latin America to loosen abortion restrictions. Argentina, Uruguay, and Cuba also allow abortion without restrictions up to a certain point. But countries like El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and the Dominican Republic still prohibit the procedure under all circumstances. Next, to Asia. Construction crews in Hong Kong are building special isolation facilities in hopes of containing a surge in COVID-19 cases. China is the only major economy trying to impose a zero COVID strategy, despite ample evidence that it doesn't work. Under new restrictions, Hong Kong's 7.4 million residents must submit to three rounds of virus tests starting in March. Between those tests, they must take multiple rapid antigen tests every day at home. Anyone who tests positive will be strictly quarantined. Health officials have reported thousands of new cases every day. Officials say the surge threatens to overwhelm the city's hospitals. And finally, we end today in Indonesia. 10 special couples tied the knot in a group wedding ceremony in West Java on Tuesday. A charity for the blind organized the event to coincide with a date many there consider lucky, 2/22/22. Blind people in Indonesia often face discrimination because of their disability. And blind couples, especially from poor families, often don't have the means to marry. One bride said she didn't mind sharing her special day with others. She called the ceremony spectacular. That's it for this week's World Tour. Reported for World, I'm Onize Ohikere in Abuja, Nigeria.
Well, I think you've heard the punchline to this old joke. Where does a great big bear sit? Answer, of course, anywhere he wants to, right?
He wants to.
Well, look, it's no joke for a particular 500-pound bear known as Hank the Tank. He is terrorizing the locals now in Lake Tahoe, California, because, well, he wants to sit where he wants to sit, and that place may just be your kitchen. Hank the Tank allegedly has broken into at least 30 properties around Lake Tahoe. He hasn't harmed anyone, not yet. They say he's just after their food. A couple of young locals told CBS Sacramento they can't be too careful.
It's really scary because we used to be able to go on like walks and bike rides by ourselves, but it's become like a bigger problem.
So now we bring the bear horns whenever we go on walks or bike rides.
I think I would declare a moratorium on the walks and bike rides, you know, just for now.
Me too.
Yeah. Hank the Tank is getting pretty brazen, you know. He smashed a window and squeezed into one house while the homeowners were still there. Police responded and banged on the outside of the house until Hank went out the back and disappeared into the woods. Officials are nowhere close to quitting this particular bear hunt. Hank has zero fear of people, and he just needs to be relocated to a zoo or a wildlife sanctuary anywhere but your pantry, right? It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, protesting China's human rights abuses.
The International Olympic Committee has the honor to announce the host city of the Olympic Winter Games 2022. Beijing.
Regional protests over the IOC selection of Beijing began almost immediately after that announcement on July 31st back in 2015. But in recent months, those protests grew stronger and more numerous.
This year's Winter Olympics are but one example of how China is using sports, money, and investment in infrastructure around the world to whitewash their human rights violations. We must and we have to see this for what it is.
Open Doors USA was just one of many nonprofit groups that encouraged their supporters to boycott the Winter Games over China's crackdown on religious minorities.
So what effect did those protests have? World's Paul Butler has a look.
Boycotts are nothing new. The first international boycott in the modern Olympic era occurred in 1956 as China and six other countries skipped out on the Melbourne Games. Other notable boycotts include the 1964 Tokyo Games, 1976 Montreal Games, and most famously, the 1980 Moscow Games, when the United States and 64 other countries protested Russia's involvement in Afghanistan.
And I have notified the Olympic Committee that with Soviet invading forces in Afghanistan, Neither the American people nor I will support sending an Olympic team to Moscow.
While there may have been geopolitical solidarity, many athletes who had trained for years to compete in the 1980 Olympics protested the move, like Canadian track and field star Diane Jones-Konohowski. Audio here from Global News.
Well, I spoke out very strongly against it. I really felt that it was wrong. There's nothing more peaceful than an Olympic Games at the athlete level.
In the long run, the 1980 boycott had little effect. But 40 years later, athletes like former Boston Celtics center Enes Kanter believe that today's international sporting boycotts are a powerful tool for applying political pressure. Kanter called for a complete U.S. boycott of the Beijing Winter Games during this November 23, 2021 interview with CNN.
You know, the important thing is we cannot just have these kind of games are happening where there is a genocide happening while we are speaking right now.
2 weeks later, the Biden administration announced that neither the president nor any other government official would attend the games. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The athletes on Team USA have our full support. We will not be contributing to the fanfare of the games.
When Open Doors USA announced their 2022 World Watch list earlier this year, President David Curry commended the Biden administration's decision and asked Christians around the world to join in.
And today, Open Doors USA is calling on every Christian in our nation to join this boycott of the Olympics in the name of our persecuted brothers and sisters in China.
Olympic boycotts can leave athletes in the middle. Two-time Olympic cross-country skier Noah Hoffman offered this perspective during a recent interview on Fox.
Athletes have no control over where the Olympics are held. They are just at the mercy of the International Olympic Committee and at the mercy of the host country. And this has been a huge distraction from their sport, and it makes them pawns in this geopolitical fight. It's just a terrible place for athletes to be.
But there is anecdotal evidence that the attention given to China's human rights abuses may have had an effect. Television and streaming ratings were down as much as 48% over the last Winter Games 4 years ago. Now, there are many possible explanations, of course, including the large time difference, but it seems likely that the pressure from the international community at least played a part. And that encourages Open Doors USA President David Curry.
I have to put in a caveat. I love the Olympics. I love watching the Olympics. I think the drama of that competition and the way it has the potential to pull people together is amazing. But the International Olympic Committee and these kinds of groups keep awarding these games to people who have these major human rights violations, and I just think it sends all the wrong signals.
Curry says he's uncertain if Open Doors' call to boycott the games had much effect. If it did, he acknowledges that it may not last long.
There's limited effect they can have, but right now China is desperate for the attention and for the world to sort of overlook all that's gone on. But if people are now talking about the things that China doesn't want you to talk about, if they're talking about what's happening to Uyghur Muslims in the northwest of the country where there's at least 1 million people in a concentration camp, and the things that they're doing to the Christian population. We have to call that out. And I think that's the limited but positive effect this sort of thing can have.
While a few athletes have spoken up against China since the games concluded, not many did so during them. But Curry understands.
I think the best thing an athlete can do is to compete with honor and to use their platform to celebrate the competition. I would have hoped that some would speak out, but I don't hold that against them. Their job is to go there and compete on behalf of their country and do so honorably.
Now that the games are over, Curry wants to make sure that China's religious abuses aren't forgotten, like most Olympic fourth place finishers. He's calling for the same level of pressure to be applied to businesses that manufacture in China, insisting on protections against slave labor, who are often persecuted Christians or Uyghurs. Curry is concerned that the recent attention may have unintended consequences for believers in China, that the CCP may crack down even more. But he's hopeful that the Chinese church and the American church standing with them will remain strong and bold.
They're already monitoring every behavior, using facial recognition to go into church. They're monitoring every phone when you buy it. They're putting you on a no-fly list. You could lose your job. Your kids may not get into university. It's a small step from that to controlling a digital currency and keeping people from commerce if they're a follower of Jesus. I certainly hope that the American church would care and pray and speak out for the Chinese believers who can't do so.
Reporting for World, I'm Paul Butler.
Today is Wednesday, February 23rd. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Parents have quite a long list of things to teach their children while they're still young, but World founder Joel Bells is going to talk now about one important lesson parents too often neglect.
The good news here at World is that the year 2021 ended with the highest level of gift support from our readers and listeners that we've ever had. The bad news is that I'm not sure that level of support is sustainable, not because of anything we've done or will do, but because the next generation might not have the same capacity to give as their parents and grandparents did. Today's children have been born into what is almost certainly the wealthiest generation in the history of the world. And eventually, they will be inheriting much of that wealth. The manner in which they steward those resources will radically affect the well-being of thousands of Christian ministries. The challenge comes back to me. What am I doing to see that my children and grandchildren are exposed to biblical principles of stewardship? Here are several facets I think are pertinent. First, we need to teach them that all wealth is God's wealth. Those who call themselves billionaires, as much as the homeless man going through garbage cans in the alley, have what they have only on loan from their Creator. That realization changes everything. Second, there's no limit to the amount of wealth just waiting to be developed. But on the other hand, there's no pie in the sky waiting to be distributed fairly. Third, the tithe has always been and will continue to be a teaching tool used by God to coach His children as they adventure to creatively exciting wealth-building assignments. Just see, God says in Malachi 3, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing so big that you will not have room to receive it. Fourth, our children need to know that apart from God's intervention, they will not live in as wealthy a nation and culture as we have. They will have to exercise more discipline than we did. We need to be gently relentless in passing that assignment on to them. Fifth, paying interest on a loan of almost any type is simply a not-so-clever dodge for paying a significantly higher price for some goods or services than you first agreed to. Realistically, agreeing to an interest charge is to say that you were too impatient to wait until you could afford to pay cash for what you were buying. And finally, our children will be able to manage these concepts only if they are also versed in at least a rudimentary form of bookkeeping and accounting. My sense is our nation's parents have effectively ignored this important teaching assignment. So, too, have Christian parents. If not ignored, then at best deferred as if unimportant. Our local churches, not to mention our mission organizations, our Christian educational institutions, our relief agencies, and many others, could all be in financial jeopardy because our present generation didn't bother to educate the givers of tomorrow on these very important matters. I'm Joel Bells.
Tomorrow, crisis in Ukraine. We'll talk with a military analyst to find out what Vladimir Putin's next move might be. And athletic events for people with disabilities. We'll visit a special day camp in the land down under. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Myrna Brown. The World and Everything in It comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Bible says, we love because He first loved us. Go now, in grace and peace.